supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a lot to get done today, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we are going to let a listener turn us on to a great mulch her landscaper found for her. You won't believe what it's made from, but you might believe that you have similar naturally available resources near you. We're also going to talk to the author of a new book on container gardening to expand your ideas of places you can plop your plants into. That's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Marilyn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. How are you?
I am doing just fine, Marilyn. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
And where is Marilyn pretty good?
I am in Shreveport, Louisiana.
All right. What can we do for Marilyn?
Okay. I have two plum trees. They're different breeds of plum. I can't think of the names of them now. One of them has the one with the yellow meat, and the other one has the red meat. But I put them close together, so I guess they have pollinated each other. But that is not the problem. The problem is the first year, of course, I didn't let them produce plums. I took all the little blooms off of them. So the second year, I let them, and I had so many plums that they were breaking my limbs. I had a lot of fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the year after that, one of them bloomed, and the other one didn't make fruit. And the one that did make fruit had a kind of powder on the fruit itself. So I didn't see it when it initially came on, when whatever it was that was attacking my plums came on. I didn't see that. But later on, I saw that it had a powdery something on it, so mm-hmm. I lost all the fruit that year. The next year, the same thing happened. Only one of them had, like, where the blooms had fallen off and had a little bitty fruit, and the other one had fruit, but that fruit had all this brown powder on it. So I asked the people at the co-op here in Louisiana what it was. They didn't know.
I do.
You do?
Oh, yeah. What you have been experiencing is a disease called brown rot that is a disease of high humidity that mostly or worstly attacks trees that have not been properly cared for.
Okay.
These are trees that must be heavily pruned every winter, and I mean heavily. Have you done that?
I did prune them one year. I think it was like after the second year. I did prune them, and I pruned them real good. They looked like they had been butchered. But the last couple of years, I have not pruned them because, I mean, they didn't make fruit.
Okay, here's what you do. First of all, as I tell everybody with fruit, I would recommend you go out and buy one of Lee Reich's books. Lee Reich is one of our leading experts on fruit. He's a good friend of mine. He's a good friend of the show. His last name is spelled R-E-I-C-H.
Okay.
And he has a book called The Pruning Book and a book called Grow Fruit Naturally. Either one of those would hold your hand.
Okay.
But what I want to tell you is in late winter, before the trees flower, you should go out and prune out any branches that are straight up, any branches that are crowding certain areas, and remove a good third of the branches in the tree as you're doing this, thinking about light and air, getting light and air to all parts of the tree.
Okay.
When you are finished, Lee says, you should be able to pick up a cat, toss the cat up between the pruned branches, and not have it touch any of the branches. That's how much room you need.
Oh, my. Okay.
And you need that more than anybody because of the high humidity and the extra diseases prevalent down south.
Wow.
This pruning will also stimulate flower production.
Mm-hmm.
But after the pruning, the flowers will form. And then, you know, when you get those fruits that are the size of, like, your thumbnail and stuff, Start removing them. You want to remove at least every other fruit. You want to make sure there's plenty of room. Fruit trees produce more than they can ripen up. So to get the kind of fruits that we really crave, we prune the trees heavily in the winter, and then we thin the fruits as they're developing. So you want to take off a good third of them. You want to make sure there's plenty of room between fruits. And then make sure you don't ever wet the leaves of the plants overnight. And if you want some extra insurance, there is an organic product called Surround. It's a micronized clay spray. You put it in a sprayer, mix it with water, shake it up, and you spray it on your plants, and it covers the fruits and the leaves with a thin film that protects them against disease and insects. It's the only thing I spray on my fruit trees.
Wow, that would be great. Yeah.
So beginning next winter, you're going to prune them real well for light and air. You're going to thin the young fruits, and I think you're going to be really happy with the results.
I am so excited because I was at a loss. It's like, wait, they did this 1 year. What happened? And it probably being the first year, they weren't as crowded.
Exactly
now
right.
Now that they've grown over, they've gotten bigger and more crowded, and that's why I have the problem.
Exactly, but it's a fixable problem.
You know, I knew there was a reason why I listened to you. You come on down here at 6 o'clock in the morning. Saturday morning.
Well, it's good to get up. It's still cool then. That's when you should get out and
do
your gardening. Yeah. All right, Marilyn. You take care.
You
stay cool.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Ernest, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, I had a question about a crepe myrtle that I planted 3-4 years ago. And it was doing real good, and I had it alongside my house, and a car ran over it and flattened it.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Well, first, Ernest, where do you live?
In Germantown, Philadelphia.
They ran your tree over with a car.
Yeah, there was, like, parking problems, and everything was flattened. I cut it off, and then the following season, it came back.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when I bought it from the nursery, there was like a leader that they spliced to it, I think, because I heard that they, you know, make a stronger stock to something. And that stock is gone. So what was coming up was like suckers. And I was getting a lot of suckers, a lot of little branches, and I was getting flowers and everything.
And you were getting crepe myrtle flowers.
Yes.
Okay.
Lavender color.
Okay. And how old was it when it got hit by the car?
About 2 years.
So that's not an old plant.
Right.
Had you been doing any pruning or anything?
Just the dead stuff.
Oh, and you would do that when?
As I saw it.
Oh, okay. All right. So crepe myrtle is a southern plant. You never saw them in the Philadelphia area up until around 5-10 years ago.
Yes.
But as the climate has changed, as our area has mostly gotten warmer, although that last winter dropped us back a zone for a long time,
we
have been growing more and more of these southern plants. Now, a lot of people in the spring, when the crepe myrtle begins growing again, will give it a pruning. And it actually is very good to prune crepe myrtles in the spring. It kind of rejuvenates them. It helps with their flowering. Now, your tree is only 2 years old, 2-3 years old, so I don't think that's going to be an issue. So right now, you have some branches coming out of it, and you don't have flowers yet. You got flowers last year, right?
Well, no, I don't have no flowers, but the problem this year is I had one, the leaves would fall off little by little, and when they would fall off the branches, I would cut it back. Now, this year, this spring, I had leaves and everything, and then little by little, leaves fell off, and I didn't cut it back. Right now, where I stand, there's no leaves on it right now.
Oh, okay. Then it's just dead, man.
Okay. Yeah.
The progression of a crepe myrtle is it goes dormant, it blooms very late in the summer,
right.
Holds on to those blooms. You're supposed to just leave it alone over winter.
Right.
And then in the spring, when you begin to see new growth, then you're supposed to cut it back a little bit, and that keeps the plant to the correct size and the right kind of shape. Your crepe myrtle is one of the few plants that could be run over and not die completely from it.
Right.
But it sounds like maybe you were pruning it in the fall before.
I don't know.
Anything you did like that would have killed it more than the car.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think I did too much pruning to it.
What I would suggest to you is this is not a street tree, the crepe. You're the first street tree crepe myrtle I've ever heard of, and I've been in this business 30 years,
yeah,
man
well,
and
it's
dog.
It's on the side of my house. It's not really on the street.
But I would suggest, because you live in the Philadelphia area,
yeah,
you know PHS, the Pennsylvania Horticultural
yes,
Society.
Yes.
Go online and look at their tree tenders program.
Okay.
They will suggest trees that are more rugged for an area like that. And if you do want to replant a crepe myrtle, you should be able to find a nice one in the fall.
Okay.
You can always dig this one up and replant it. Just remember to leave it alone until it starts growing again in the spring. Give it a light pruning in the spring, and you'll... It's a very tough and rugged tree.
Okay. Hey, Mike, thanks. Thank you very, very much. And I think I am going to dig it up in the fall and put another one in because I just love crepe myrtles.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ernest.
Bye, Mike.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be doing a very special meet and greet and answering your garden questions live and in person on Saturday, August 2nd, beginning around 4 o'clock as part of the 10th annual Iron Hill Twilight Bike Race and Street Festival in downtown Westchester, PA. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, how things like thistle and nettles can be good for your garden, and all the things that you can use to make great containers out of for all those extra plants you got hanging around. I'm hanging around Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more are online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, thistle, nettle, how can these things be good? It's all in the way the material is used. You may even have some, quote, bad material in your area that you can turn into a big garden helper. We'll tell you all about it in the question of the week. We're also going to take more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it is time to talk about one of my favorite topics, gardening in containers. All right, as promised, it's time for our interview with Stacy Hervella. She is the author of Edible Spots and Pots, Small Space Gardens for Growing Vegetables and Herbs in Containers, Raised Beds, and More. It is a new book from Rodale, and it is an excellent read. Stacy joins us through the kind auspices of WGVU. FM. Stacy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's great to be here.
It is great to have you here. Now, I realize this may be faint praise, but not coming from me. I get a lot of gardening books, and I read through them until I get to, like, generally page 7 and go, has this person ever gardened? Have they read anything written new in the last 20 years? So many books pass on bad old information. And I can't remember the last time I read through a book and kept nodding my head in agreement. It was like, oh my God, somebody else knows these things.
Oh, that's great to hear. Yeah, I definitely wanted, I was so excited to have this opportunity to dispel a lot of the myths, especially about container gardening and about growing vegetables and about gardening in general. So it was a great opportunity, and I'm glad that someone gets it, because it seems like every time I go and do a talk and I talk about container drainage, my audience, their mind just gets blown.
So when it comes to container gardening, and you seem to be like me, you seem to have a predilection for real containers, things that were professionally made to work well, but also an eye towards something that's going to be fun, that's maybe only going to last a season or two, but is going to look so cool that we're going to put some drainage holes in it and make it work.
There's no doubt about it. When you're starting in container gardening, or even if you've been doing it for a while, it's expensive. You know, the containers are pricey. So I definitely understand why people want to, you know, repurpose things or sort of have a DIY option.
When it comes to container gardening, I certainly know what I think my secrets are. I'll turn it over to you. What's the most important thing that people need to know about growing in containers instead of in the soil? And is it the thing they screw up on the most?
I don't know if it's the thing they screw up on the most, but I would say the number one misconception is that you can really use any container to grow anything. And, you know, you really need to pick sizes that are appropriate to the crop that you're growing. And the bigger the crop, the bigger the container you need. And, you know, I attribute this to the fact that plant roots don't get a lot of credit, right? We don't see them, so we don't think about them. And, you know, but there's a direct relationship between the size and volume of the plant roots and the top growth. And when you're growing vegetables, you want a lot of top growth, so you're going to need to have ample room for the roots. So when you're starting out, you know, and you're making that initial investment in your containers, you definitely want to have a good part of that in 16, 18, you know, even up to 20, 22-inch containers. And that way, you'll be able to grow more. You'll be able to grow larger crops, you know, like okra and tomatoes and zucchini. Or if you choose not to grow those, you'll be able to grow more of smaller crops in them. So that gives you the most versatility.
You will never wish you had smaller containers.
That's exactly true. That's a great point.
We had a situation our last winter, like so many other people's, was just hellish. And the poor guy who came around with a backhoe to move snow away from my house so that we could get ready for more snow to come just decimated my old fake terracotta plastic containers that were sitting out on our patio. And I looked at them, and they had gotten old. They were impossible to pick up. They had little cracks in them anyway. And I just decided to bite the bullet, get rid of them all, and line up 4 half whiskey barrels with holes drilled in the bottom. And it's like I've tripled my garden space.
You know, whiskey barrels, when you can find them, and usually it's only at the beginning of the season because they sell out pretty quickly, they're pretty affordable. You know, they're one of the best ways to get a really significant volume of space for your container garden. I mean, they were selling in our area here for about $30 a pop, and that's not half bad for something that's going to, you know, look that good and last that long.
Your point about allowing for the root growth is so important, and I loved your reverse example of the famous upside-down tomato plant.
Well, that's the only way it's making sense to people because, you know, it looks all so great. Anything on an infomercial when it comes to gardening, you got to take with a grain of salt. So it looks so great when they see it there. And, you know, that's the way you need to think of it, is not as an upside-down container, but as an actual container. And then think, you know, will this actually work? Because if you put that thing upside down on the floor, there is no way in heck you would think that would be appropriately sized for a tomato.
It's like a quart of soil in that stupid bag.
Really small.
And you're really kind in your book. You're saying you'll have to water it every day. I was thinking hourly if that thing is sitting out in the sun.
No, it's true. And you know what? What really makes me upset about those is that when people fail they blame themselves. They don't think that, oh, I was sold a bunk product and I won't have that. You know, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is to try to get people excited and to try to, you know, help them make the right decisions in the first place, no matter what, you know, all the crazy products out there are telling them they can achieve.
It strikes me that it's all these people who, they buy a house, and of course the house doesn't have working plumbing, the electricity is sparking all the time, but all they want to do is rip up the backyard and put in a farm. And it occurs to me that one of the best ways to learn about gardening would be to start in containers.
Yeah, definitely. You know, like I say, when I give my talk about the book, what really sums up to me all of the multitude of advantages of growing vegetables in containers is it gives you more control over all of the factors that would otherwise cause your garden to fail. No, you can't control the weather, but you can, for example, in a container, very easily make a mini greenhouse if you're going to have cold weather threatening. You know, put some bamboo stakes in and wrap a tarp or wrap some plastic or an old blanket around that and get it through a couple of nights. So, you know, whereas in the garden, it would be a lot harder. You're stepping on your other seedlings when you're trying to do that. It's easier to protect them from, you know, rodents and rabbits and deer and all of these other critters. It's even easier to protect from insects. So everything that would otherwise cause your garden to fail or cause you to have a bad experience in gardening, you actually can control that for the most part in a container.
All right, well, let's go back to some basics. One of the things I try to drill into people when I'm talking about containers is your garden soil is death on a stick to plants in the dirt. So don't even think about using it for plants in prison in a container. And I find people have a hard time wrapping their head around the concept of a soil-free mix.
They definitely do. And, you know, the manufacturers and things don't really do us any favors. I love when I do this talk at a garden center and I pull several different products off the shelf and one says container mix, one says potting soil, one says container soil, you know, and there's just this multitude of names and different things out there. But, you know, all of those products, they really are designed for ideal growth in a container, you know, quick drainage, but yet holding moisture, lightweight, plenty of pore space in there so the roots can get plenty of air. And, you know, yes, it is an investment, and I understand that. And that's why, you know, I tried to give a lot of alternatives or ways to stretch your potting soil. But yeah, people sort of have trouble with the idea that they're going to have to, you know, spend a chunk of change filling their containers with that.
It's an investment. It is the biggest investment. I've cut more corners than a guy who designs envelopes. But when it comes to filling my containers, the lowest I'll go is to use old potting soil from an old pot. And even then, I'll figure it's gotten heavy over time, as many of us have, and I'll add a lot of perlite to lighten it up. But none of my containers have ever seen garden soil.
I recommend that you also augment it with compost. You know, potting soils are made out of organic matter. They're not like a regular soil made out of mineral matter. So a potting soil made out of peat moss and bark, all of those things are constantly decomposing. So you're losing some volume every year. And yeah, perlite is a great way to add that bulk back in. Compost also adds some nutrients and some stability back in terms of the weight.
I think the ideal container mix is roughly one-third peat moss with a little bit of lime or wood ash to balance out the pH, one-third perlite, and one-third compost. I mean, you've got the lightness, you've got the drainage, you've got the nutrition, you've got the organic matter. The plants will grow themselves in that kind of a medium.
That's what it's all about. When you grow in containers, you don't have to say, well, the sunniest spot is my driveway, so I can't grow anything. You can actually grow the tomatoes, you know, in your driveway. And, you know, I love flowers. I'm a plant geek. I love all sorts of stuff. But for my money, if I have a sunny deck or a sunny patio, I'd rather be looking at tomatoes and basil than, you know, petunias and geraniums. So that's just me. But that's what you can do. You can maximize your space and beautify your yard at the same time.
And that's why the book is called Edible Spots and Pots, as opposed to just Pretty Spots and Pots. But I think it's real easy to do both when you're growing in containers. I think the plants tend to show themselves off so much more when they're in that kind of a frame. Stacy Hervella is the author of Edible Spots and Pots, Small Space Gardens for Growing Vegetables and Herbs. It really is a great new book from Rodale. It's a complete guide to picking out your containers, filling your containers, unusual containers, where to put them, what to grow in them, and a great basic guide on growing a lot of the edibles that we all enjoy, whether you're growing them in a garden or in a container. It's a very complete book. Great job, Stacy. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy gardening.
You too. And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. William, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, William. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thanks. And you?
I am just ducky.
Okay, and I'm in Schnecksville, Pennsylvania.
Schnecksville. So what can we do for William in the town of Schneck?
My yard is being overrun with Japanese stilt grass. It's in the lawn. It's mixed into the ground cover. It's around the trees. It's kind of everywhere. And I first noticed it about 5 years ago, had a big patch of it in my gravel driveway, which really didn't bother me that much. But last year, it started out about 10% of the lawn, and this year, it's up to 40% of the lawn. So I looked online, and it looked like it's a plant rather like crabgrass. It's an annual grass. It comes up a little earlier than crabgrass, and it dies a little sooner than crabgrass. So I thought probably a pre-emergence technique would work, and I went and bought the corn gluten meal at a local supplier, and I put it down on April 15th, and 3 weeks later I had more stiltgrass come up than imaginable. So I either have to conclude that I didn't get it down early enough, I didn't put enough down, or I wasn't using the right stuff.
Let's back up. Do you know what kind of grass you have?
It was whatever the Agway sold for the mix in this part of Pennsylvania.
Right, so it was a sun and shade mix. And what do you have?
Right now I have a lot more shade than I used to have.
Right, right.
In fact, that's predominantly where the stilt grass is in the shade.
Uh-huh. Two kinds of grasses, desired grasses, that is. Things like Kentucky bluegrass and zoysia grass that spread to fill in their own bare spots. They run sideways. But they need sun. When you have to deal with shade, you almost always turn towards a fescue, especially for the cool season grasses. Mm-hmm. And these are clumping grasses that the deeper the shade, the more they need to be overseeded every season. So in one way, the stilt grass is really just filling in spaces that came to be naturally, because clumping grasses can't repair themselves. So how high do you cut your lawn?
3 inches.
I would like you to go up to 3.5 because you're in shade. Do you feed your lawn anything other than corn gluten meal?
No.
Okay. Do you feed your lawn anything in the fall?
No.
Okay. And how big is the lawn?
I think I probably have around 12,000 square feet of lawn.
Okay, so that's a lot of lawn.
Yeah.
And do you care about it all, or are you mostly concerned with the part that wraps around your house that you see all the time?
I'm honestly not a great carer for lawns.
Okay, so here's your two choices. You can pretend that the Japanese stilt grass is just one of many grasses in your lawn, mow it at 3 inches high, and go home early.
Mm-hmm.
If you want an area that, like, say, in front of your house, that's really an area on display, what I would suggest is you till that area up beginning in August and rake out as many of the rhizomes and all the old green material as you can, level the area, which is critically important, have a big load of, where you live, perhaps aged high-quality mushroom soil or compost delivered. And then in that area that we're going to repair, spread that about an inch deep, and again, level it. Leveling is so important. And then in this new seedbed, somewhere between August 15th and August 30th, sow the seed of a very shade-loving fescue. and make sure you buy a named variety so that in the future you can replace this seed, you can match it. If you sow it between August 15th and August 30th, water it till the seed comes up, you now have a bulletproof lawn in that area. If you mow that lawn at 3.5 inches high and you spread some matching seed every fall or two, that grass will outcompete the stilt grass. Again, if you don't care, just cut everything at 3 inches. It's not hurting anybody. If the rhizomes are moving it into an area you don't want, drive edging into those areas to protect them from the grass creeping laterally.
Okay, so the stilt grass is spreading?
I believe it spreads by seed and by rhizome.
Okay. So the pre-emergence technique is not going to work.
Well, yes, it will. It will do two things. It will help limit the growth of the stilt grass, but it'll also feed your good grass if you get it down at the right time.
And what is the right time, do you think?
You know, for stilt grass, I don't know that one off the top of my head, but your local county extension agent will.
Okay.
So find out the germination time and make sure you got the corn gluten meal in hand a month before that.
Okay.
All right. You be good, sir.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind gardeners with itchy fingers and an ear for idle rumors that the only suckers that require pruning in the vegetable garden are the ones defoliating their own tomato plants. Every healthy leaf is a solar panel, collecting energy to fuel your fruits. Start pruning leaves away and you'll get fewer, smaller, and perhaps even sunburned tomatoes. But don't go looking for all the details under the letter T in the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fascinating phone calls and how to get things like thistle and nettle to work for you. I'm hardworking Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more are online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, which is either about nettle plants or about utilizing locally available resources. Maybe it's both. You're going to find out after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Penny, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Penny. How are you?
Fine, thank you. I enjoy listening to your information and how to revive the trees or plants or whatever.
Okay.
But I had problem since I have my red raspberry put in. I have blooms, but there's no fruit. because they dried up.
That is highly unusual. Where do you live, Penny?
I live in Vineland, South Jersey.
Sure, I know exactly where that is, just over the Ben Franklin Bridge from Center City, Philly. And did you say you had someone plant raspberries for you?
No, I planted them myself.
Okay, where did you get the plants?
I purchased from the nursery.
Okay, and when did you put them in the ground?
I would say June, early June.
Of this year?
No. It's at least 2 years ago.
Okay. So you put them in the ground in June of 2 years ago. Did you get berries at the end of that season?
Nothing.
Okay.
Never got any berry at all. No bloom, but this year has a lot of bloom, but when it starts change to fruit,
mm-hmm.
it dried up.
Okay. And how many plants did you put in the ground originally?
Two.
And how many do you have now?
Too many.
Oh, okay. So you were not prepared for the fact that they were going to send out runners and come up all over the place?
No.
Okay. What are they growing in? Bare ground, a lawn?
Bare ground.
Okay.
Next to a strawberry patch now, because I put strawberry patch in the ground next to it last year.
Okay. You know, that's not necessarily wise, because the raspberries might come up in the middle of the strawberries.
True. I see some plants coming up, but that should not interfere with bearing fruit, right?
No, but they'll drive a spear. They'll lift the plants right up out of the ground. Now, have you been feeding them?
No, I don't feed them.
You don't feed them anything?
Anything at all.
And what kind of soil are they in?
Not good soil, I guess.
Well, that's fine. Do you water them? Does this area hold water?
Yes, it does hold water.
Oh, okay. Raspberries are one of the easiest fruits to grow. They grow in very poor soil. They don't need any nutrition. As you can see, they love to propagate. They love to come up. The only thing that can hurt a raspberry is what's called wet feet. They need their soil to drain well.
Okay.
So the nice thing about raspberries, yours have not died. They keep sending up new runners, right?
Correct. I keep getting babies.
Right. But the babies, the same thing happens. Okay. So here's what you do. Do you have any areas on your property that do drain nicely?
I think so.
Okay. Do nothing now because it's too late in the season. The heat is going to be too intense. And then fall is not a good time to move them. But next spring, you know those babies will begin popping up out of the ground again, right?
Yes.
When the babies begin coming up out of the ground in spring, just get a little shovel or a trowel and move them to another place on your property that doesn't hold water. And that's really all you need to do. Once they can dry out between waterings and between rains, you're going to get a ton of raspberries.
Okay.
There are very few plants that can even survive in a wet spot, but I can't think of many fruiting plants that would be happy in a wet spot.
Okay. 2 years ago, I put cuttings of the black raspberry behind it.
Uh-huh.
They are bearing fruits like crazy this
okay.
year.
Okay, good. Good.
But the red ones got nothing.
Okay.
I got nothing. The red one.
So, again, my advice is still the same. This next spring, when move all the new plants to another part of your property, and I think you'll get good results.
All right. Thank you so much, Mike.
All right, Penny. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Kurt, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Kurt. How are you, sir?
Just fine. You doing okay?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Let's just say so and cut to the chase.
Okay. I have two persimmon trees. It's here in my backyard. And one of them is probably 32 inches in diameter, and the other one is probably 28, 29. And they've been there, Lord knows telling how long, but every year in May, the whole tree just turned white with blooms, and all the blooms will fall off and never produce any persimmons. And the blooms, when they fall off and go to decomposing, they keep killing all my grass, which makes all my soil run down into my driveway. And I'm trying to figure out what I can put in there to keep the grass and my soil in my backyard.
And where are you, Kurt?
I am in very extreme southwest Arkansas.
You know, the persimmon tree with the fruit that I think my friend Lee Reich calls allegedly edible was one of Bob Rodale's favorite trees, and it is a Native American tree. Now, you inherited your persimmon, right?
Yes, they've been there ever since the house has been here, and the house was built in the 30s.
And have they ever fruited successfully for you?
I have never seen a persimmon on it. My uncle remembers the trees when he was little, and he says he's never seen a persimmon on it.
And you say when they drop their leaves, it kills your lawn? Is that some toxic thing, or it just smothers it?
Well, what they're doing is they don't drop their leaves in the May. When the blooms come on in April, all the blooms fall off in May, which is what in southwest Arkansas we call it a May drop, because, you know, the trees will actually shed everything that it's not going to be able to take care of. And when the blooms hit the ground, the ground just turns brown, and it even kills all the grass.
Well, is it possible that you wound up with two trees of the exact same variety?
Yes, I do believe they're both male trees, yes.
Well, then you're not going to get any fruit.
Well, I'm not wanting fruit. I'm just trying to figure out how to keep my grass from dying when the blooms fall off and it kills my grass.
Yeah, and again, that flips me out. I don't know of any, like, toxicity in persimmon flowers, although when Bob Rodale made me eat a persimmon, I thought the fruit was pretty toxic. So what's going on? Is it smothering the grass, or do you see the grass turn brown where the petals hit it?
The grass is turning just dying off and turning brown, and I'm assuming that it's happening from the decomposition of the bloom dying and giving off that grass, gas killing the grass, and I'm just at a loss of what to do for my grass anymore.
And what kind of grass is it, man?
Well, I have planted St. Augustine. I have planted a little bit of Zoya there.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing seems to take root.
Okay.
It'll take root first of the year before blooms start falling and start doing good, and my grass starts doing good, and then when the blooms hit the ground, it just goes south.
Which is odd, because that's the time of year, as you know, those warm season grasses should be really hitting their stride.
Right.
Does your grass go dormant over the winter, or are you warm enough that it's green year-round?
It'll go dormant. When it comes out of dormancy, I'll fertilize my yard and keep it watered. My wife, she waters a lot of the flowers and plants there in the backyard, and the grass really starts doing well. And then the blooms hit, and it just goes straight to dirt. There's nothing, not even grass will grow there. Now, I'm starting to get a little bit of grass there now. Since, you know, May's done and the blooms are gone, I'm starting to get a little bit of grass back, but it's the same cycle every year. You know, I'll start getting a little bit of grass, and then when the summertime heat comes on, you know, it'll kick it back again, you know, and it's just a constant battle.
Right. When the summertime heat kicks back our grasses, the summertime heat makes your grasses super strong, theoretically. So here's what I'm going to suggest. It's kind of a weird concept that these flowers could be doing this, but anything's possible. And if I sense what your basic question is, there's these old farmer's tales, you can drive nails of certain metal into the trees and they won't flower. And of course, none of that is true. But what you could do is when the flowers appear, you could get a roll of fine netting.
Awesome.
You know, like the things they would use to protect ponds that have fish in them from fish-eating birds and to keep the leaves out, and wait till these flowers drop, and then they would drop onto this material, and you could roll it up and dispose of them. Either that, or get yourself a leaf blower that has a reverse setting, and as the flowers fall, vacuum them up a little bit every morning or every evening so that they're not laying on the grass for any extended period of time. Or, conversely, just cut the trees down if you don't like them.
Oh, I love my trees. They are really beautiful trees. I get a lot of shade off of them. They shade the house. They're huge.
Okay. And you know one thing I'm going to suggest, too, then, if you're going to keep them, why don't you get them a girlfriend? These two lonely guys, they're wandering around Arkansas. You know, they're turning toxic. They're killing lawns. Get them a girlfriend, and maybe things will work out for the better. You know.
I'd like to be able to walk around in the yard in the fall instead of slipping and sliding in the persimmon slam.
Yeah, well, there you go. You can't win one way or the other, can you, Kurt?
No, you sure can't.
All right, you take care, sir.
All right, you have a good day.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. When thistles are your friend, making use of abundantly available local materials. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden. Get us started, please.
Well, Mike, Aviva in Eugene, Oregon, sent you a lengthy email that you said was so good you were tempted to just read it in its entirety on the show this week.
Yeah, a lot of time a, quote, long email is either 18 different complex questions or somebody wants me to do their landscape design for free. But every once in a while, you get one where somebody shares a wonderful story. And or reveals a great tip that our listeners can use. So first, I'll have you do a little setup.
Okay. So Aviva writes, I've been an avid listener for years and wanted to share some garden methods that are new to me thanks to a landscaper I was able to hire. Because of arthritis, I need help in the yard and am now able to garden fairly well with raised beds that are a mix of 3-foot-high cedar-framed boxes and some lower raised beds for tall plants. Mike, that's a great tip right there, and something you're always saying. As gardeners get older or develop physical limitations, they need growing areas that are easy to reach.
Absolutely. My containers keep getting bigger and higher off the ground every season. A few years from now, I honestly expect my traditional garden area will only have garlic, tomatoes, and raspberries in it.
None of which would do well in pots.
Right, the garlic and the small fruits need to overwinter in the ground, and I grow big, honking tomato plants.
Aviva continues, my landscaper's company, Garden Starters, installs beds filled with very high-quality soil. When I hired them, they invited me out to their farm where they have a huge vermicomposting operation, and because their compost still contains a lot of the red worms that make it all happen, I have lots of worms in my beds. As a result, my kale never seems to slow down. The radishes, spinach, and peas have been crazy with flavor, and the herbs are aromatic and plentiful.
And that's the lesson that all gardeners need to learn. The secret to success is in the soil.
In conclusion, she writes, why do I share this? To tell you about the type of mulch they provide. I never saw anything like it before, but it sure works well to prevent weeds and keep moisture in the soil. It's made of finely shredded nettle stalks. This mulch has a lovely smell, and they get the raw material from a local organic herb company, thus making it sustainable as well. Mike, you're right. This is a great email, but isn't nettle a weed?
To some people, yeah, but there is also a long tradition of nettles being used in herbal medicine. In his classic book, Green Pharmacy, retired USDA botanist Dr. Jim Duke, who probably knows more about the medicinal potential of plants than anybody else on the planet, notes that stinging nettles have been used and contain the right kinds of phytochemicals to treat 19 different conditions, from allergies to tendinitis. Although the most famous use is for arthritis. Many people with arthritis swear they get relief by pulling up stinging nettle plants and just kind of slapping them against their skin.
To deliberately sting themselves?
Yeah, those little stingers are injecting them with incredibly powerful natural antihistamines and anti-inflammatories. As Jim has explained to me on many occasions, it's often the naturally occurring compounds that plants use to repel insects and herbivores, like the stuff inside those little stingers, that have the greatest medical potential. Of course, most people don't want to beat themselves with stinging plants. So if they believe in the healing power of nettles, they take the herb in supplement form.
And this landscaping company gets their mulch from a supplement maker?
Yeah, these companies begin the process with a huge bulk of plant material, from which they're only going to use certain parts like the roots of the leaves or even distillations, and that leaves behind an enormous amount of roughage to be recycled. I'll bet that similar companies have similar stocks of other weedy leftovers, like thistle, for instance. Milk thistle is highly regarded as a liver protectant and commands the same status as a prescription drug in Japan and many European countries.
But Mike, won't these weeds take root when used as mulch?
No, the material is really old and dried and woody by the time it gets recycled. And you know, these herb leftovers are also clean in another very important way. The herbs used for supplements are generally either wild-crafted, that is, harvested from the wild, or organically grown.
Yeah, but most people don't live near a supplement company.
No, but they might live near a similar resource. Back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, we ran an article on locally available materials, like manures from organically raised animals and the stalks left over from processing big plants like corn and sunflower. So you just have to expand your horizons, do a lot of networking, and pay attention. You, or in this case your super hip landscaper, may find that there's a treasure trove of really cool mulch right near your turf. Well, that sure was a different look at so-called weeds like stinging nettle and thistle, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to make me an unavailable local resource if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please, please tell us where you live. Please, please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's web page wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant is Tricia Whiting. Our hired hand is Matt Hudecki. I'm your host, Weedy Mike McGrath. And you know, if I hang around long enough, somebody may come up with a good use for me as well. In the meantime, I'll sting nettle just enough to be able to see you again next week. A few smart gardeners know to eat them, but most people seem to want to wage war on wild violets. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal yet another wondrous reason to let them be, plus your fabulous phone calls.